You are listening to a sermon recorded in 2006 at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
This is the last day of the year, and it's a time when we can reflect on our past 12 months, and we can wonder if we accomplished anything, or at least anything worthwhile and lasting. I used to work with a fellow who, whenever we were in a serious management discussion about some profound problem, Lloyd would say, "Well, fellows, in 100 years it won't make a darn bit of a difference." I have often thought of Lloyd's comments, and sometimes I think he was wrong, because our decisions do make a difference. If my parents had decided to stay in Ukraine in 1929, my life, if it existed at all, would be quite different. Decisions do have a lasting effect, and we'll see some of that in today's text. The passage from 1 Samuel describes Hannah and her husband Elkanah. Hannah was unable to have children. However, Elkanah had two wives, and his other wife bore children. And this other wife teased and ridiculed Hannah for not having children. It must have been a rough life for Hannah. She was a second wife, and she was childless. And childlessness was a social stigma in ancient Israel, and Hannah was quite despondent. And she pleaded with God to give her a son, promising to give him back to God. "I'm being humiliated," she said. "Give me a son, and I'll give him to you for the rest of his life." And eventually, God answered Hannah's prayer. Hannah conceived and gave birth to Samuel. And in her prayer of thanksgiving, Hannah praised God for giving her Samuel. And then centuries later, Mary would echo and model her own song of praise, the Magnificat, on Hannah's prayer. When Samuel was about 2 or 3 years old, Hannah and her husband went on their annual trip to the temple in Shiloh, and they left Samuel there with Eli, the chief priest. Samuel's job as a child was to assist Eli in the Lord's sanctuary, and this was a fulfillment of a vow that Hannah had made to God. Samuel, in effect, became a priest in training. And leaving her only child in the temple must have been a difficult thing for Hannah to do. I expect she only saw him once a year. Samuel was faithful, he worked hard, and there was a rapid rise in God's favor. And this contrasted sharply to Eli's own two sons. Because even though they were priests, they treated God's offerings with contempt and with scandalous behavior. They took sacrifices before they were offered to God. They ate meat before the fat was burned off against God's Levitical law. And if this was not enough, they sexually violated women who served as temple aides. Obviously, misbehavior and abuse by clergy is not new. It has a long history. Well, Eli knew about his son's wickedness and their behavior, and he confronted them. But he did not remove them from their duties. And finally, God's patience reached a breaking point, and the entire priestly line of Eli faced divine judgment. Both sons died on the same day. Samuel flourished in the temple setting, and he became a leader who oversaw the transition of Israel from judges to kings. He was powerful. He was a king breaker. He helped in Saul's reign. And he was a kingmaker. He installed David as king. The passage from Luke describes how every year Joseph and Mary and their children went to Jerusalem for the feast of the Passover. This was a celebration of God delivering the Israelites from Egypt. And pilgrims to the feast would stay a minimum of 2 days and sometimes longer. Theoretically, Jewish men were expected to go to 3 feasts in Jerusalem each year: Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, the only Passover was strictly observed. Those at some distance, especially the poor, could not attend all the feasts. Jesus was 12 years old at this Passover, just on the brink of manhood. During a boy's 12th year, he was prepared for induction as a full member of the religious community. That took place when he was 13. He had probably traveled to Jerusalem for Passover with his family before. Scripture just doesn't tell us that. After the feast was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. But his parents were unaware of this. Pilgrims to the feast in Jerusalem usually traveled in a large party or caravan because a person traveling by himself was in danger from the bandits. And the caravan was likely made up of many of Mary and Joseph's friends and relatives from Galilee. And they naturally would have assumed that Jesus was somewhere in the crowd. When they stopped for night, Jesus was nowhere to be seen, and they became alarmed. Now, by this time, they were probably a day's journey, probably about 20 miles north of Jerusalem. And they did what any responsible parent of a missing child would do. They checked with friends, checked with relatives, they searched among other campers in their company. When they discovered that no one had seen Jesus, they retreated and returned to Jerusalem. And after 3 days, and that must have been 3 days of high anxiety for the parents, they found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Now, sometimes we hear this passage explained as if Jesus was teaching the teachers, but I think that misunderstands the context. The listeners would be sitting on the ground at the feet of the teachers, who were also seated. The rabbinical style of teaching is questions on the part of the students from which discussion would arise. And in the course of the discussion, this intense boy of 12 was both listening and asking insightful questions that indicated an unusual depth of understanding. So here we have a somewhat naive 12-year-old engrossed in discussing the scriptures with the scholars. Why did he stay behind? Maybe he didn't realize that the caravan had left without him. Maybe he was rebellious and decided to stay. He obviously found a place to sleep, perhaps the friends who hadn't gone home so early. Perhaps he didn't believe that his parents would have gone home without him, that they might still be in Jerusalem. And maybe when he discovered they had already left, he decided to stay put where they could find him. Scripture just doesn't give us any of those details. Luke describes Mary and Joseph's reaction to finding him among the teachers in the temple as being astonished. I expect there was that initial relief that he was okay and surprise that he was in the temple. And then Mary's anger takes over, and she asks him, not too gently, I suppose, "Why did you do this to us?" She interprets this event in terms of how it has worried and inconvenienced her and Joseph. She talks about their sorrow, anxiety, and worry that he has caused them. "Why were you searching for me?" he said. "Didn't you know how to be in my father's house?" Now, to me, this sounds like he's sort of a smart alecky and talking back to his mother. "Didn't you know how to be in my father's house?" That's much more than a boy's naive question. I think this is probably a turning point in Jesus' life, because what he does is take the word Father and applies it to the God of the temple. And his parents did not understand what he was saying. Well, sometimes you just can't understand your teenage kids. How do you raise a son whom you believe to be the Messiah? This is a boy who, when he calls God his father, means it literally. This could be a real challenge. So they travel back to Nazareth, where he grows strong and full of wisdom, and he was obedient to his parents. So obviously staying in the temple was an unusual act, because thereafter he was obedient. What intrigues me and puzzles me is, how did Jesus learn enough about the Jewish faith to engage in dialogue with the teachers in the temple? Samuel was taken to the temple at an early age, and he virtually grew up there. He was immersed in it and in the law from early childhood on, every day. We don't know where Jesus got his religious training. Was he taught at home, in a synagogue? We just don't know. And this has led me to wonder about the religious training of children and Sunday school. Children and the need for Sunday school, and how much Jesus might have benefited from Sunday school if it had existed. Yet Sunday school didn't emerge till the 1780s in England, and it started to provide reading and writing skills to children who worked as chimney sweeps. In 20 years, there were over 200,000 children attending Sunday school in Britain. Part of it was that the people found that these working class children who worked six days a week required some form of discipline on Sunday. So they organized Sunday schools. The Sunday school and evening classes were established to teach them reading, writing, and arithmetic, and catechism. And they were intended for the deserving poor. Enrollment was decided upon by visits with parents, by nominations from subscribers, and individual student applications. The Bible was the textbook. Students were expected to attend school 4 to 5 hours a week, usually on Sundays. And this was the only schooling that most of these working class kids received. Now, while it was hailed as a great and noble achievement, Sunday schools, like any innovation, had their critics. There was often ecclesiastical pressure not to teach writing on Sunday, because writing could be construed as work and would violate a commandment. Debates raged as to whether teaching the lower classes was, in fact, a good idea. There were worries that such education would lead these children to forget their station in life. The Church of England was often unable to support the schools or provide them with adequate space or funds. Since Sunday school didn't start till the 1700s, how did Christianity survive for 1700 years without it? How was faith transmitted to children? Was it done in the home, by periodic visits to the synagogue or church? Should we worry if we don't have Sunday school for our kids? Is Sunday school one way of parents avoiding their responsibility to teach the faith to their children? Today we have youth ministers and children's ministers. We have camps for children. We have child evangelism. We have children's clubs. We have vacation Bible school and Sunday school. All of this is focused on children. Are these children's programs our way of admitting that we don't know how to communicate our faith to other adults? And we better just hammer it into our kids as early as possible and hope they don't lose the faith? I wonder about this. I mean, Christianity survived for 1700 years without Sunday school, and I would like some historian to explain to me how that happened. I just don't know. But despite all these programs, Sunday school is in trouble. Long weekends, affluence, and mobility are symbols of the problem. In our age of affluence, there has been an increase in leisure time, much of it at the expense of Sabbath rest. Christians are at the lake or on the ski slopes, and church is simply ignored or attended when it is convenient. One church in Abbotsford simply shuts down for July and August so people can go away. Recently, I read about a Southern Baptist study in 2003 that found that 88% of children from evangelical homes in the U.S. leave church around the time to leave high school. 88%. To me, that's an alarmingly high number. Because presumably many of these children attended Sunday school and youth groups and camps. The study said that many of these children never returned to the church. Well, they might still be Christians, and maybe it's just the church that has no relevance for them. We don't know. Either way, it's a disturbing statistics. Samuel was taught or apprenticed from early childhood in the temple. He was steeped in religious training. We don't know how Jesus gained his knowledge of the scriptures, but he certainly knew them, and he knew them well. We know he had no formal theological training, and neither did he require that his followers have any such training. There's a passage in John 7 where the Jews, in interaction with Jesus, make an interesting comment. They say, "How did this man get such learning without having studied?" He hadn't come through their system. They couldn't understand how he had this kind of insight. The passage from Colossians. This is a letter that was sent to predominantly Gentile converts to the Christian faith. And in his letter, Paul sends a strong warning not to be led astray by false teachers. It's a letter against rules and legalism. The teachings of Christ embody all the rules that we need. And to expand on that, Paul says, believers need to be clothed with, and he lists five characteristics: compassion, kindness, humility, quiet strength, and patience. So, if you need a New Year's theme, we could do well to follow some or all of these five characteristics: compassion, kindness, humility, quiet strength, and patience. We could take any one of those as a goal for next year, if we need one. Or we could work on each one for a few months, and by the end of the year, we'll be through the list, and we might be changed. I want to talk about compassion for a few minutes. Compassion needs to be separated from pity, from feeling sorry for another person. Compassion is a willingness to suffer with, to enter into the difficulty that another person has, to share their pain. Compassion is not a natural human response. It's an unnatural response. We thrive on competition, not on compassion. Some years ago, three Catholic academics used to meet regularly in Washington, D.C. to discuss the state of their faith. And out of that discussion emerged a book simply entitled Compassion. It's quite a remarkable book. It's one of the few books I pick up and keep reading and rereading because there is so much in it. They decided to meet with Hubert Humphrey, these three fellows, who was then the U.S. Vice President, to discuss compassion, because they considered him to be one of the most caring human beings they knew. So they went to see him. They sat around a table, and Humphrey, not sure of their agenda, was surprised when they asked him about the role of compassion in politics. He got up and went to his desk and reached for a pencil. "Gentlemen, look at this pencil. Just as the eraser is only a small part of the pencil and is used only when you make a mistake, so compassion is only called upon when things get out of hand. The main part of life is competition. Only the eraser is compassion. Compassion erases the mistakes of life, just as the eraser removes errors on paper. Getting ahead in life is a concern for most of us. Compassion is not our central concern. Our concern is to get ahead, to make it, to succeed. I don't particularly want to suffer with others. And to be compassionate means to be kind and gentle and patient with those who are hurt by the competition. Sports, school, work, games, churches, they're all competitive. Jesus told us to be compassionate as God the Father is compassionate. And many times Jesus tells us that Scripture tells us that Jesus was moved by compassion. Be compassionate as your Father is compassionate. And the Gospels continuously invite us to move from where it is comfortable, from the ordinary, from where we want to stay to the margins, to voluntarily and compassionately move to the needy and the marginalized. So I probably need to be willing to stretch and to take a risk and to begin to walk more compassionately and to move into unfamiliar and uncomfortable territory. We can't get a university degree in compassion. Compassion requires that we hear God's call, that we allow our actions to be guided by that call. In conclusion, a story. A church had fallen on hard times. Only 5 members were left, the pastor and 4 others, all over 60 years of age. In the mountains near the church, there lived a retired bishop. It occurred to the pastor to ask the bishop if he could offer any advice that might save the church. The pastor and the bishop spoke at length, but when he asked for advice, the bishop simply responded by saying, "I have no advice to give you. The only thing I can tell you is that the Messiah is one of you." The pastor, on returning to the church, told the church members what the bishop had said. In the months that followed, the church members pondered the words of the bishop, "The Messiah is one of us." And they each asked themselves, "Am I the Messiah?" As they thought about this, they all began to treat each other with extraordinary respect. On the off chance that each member might be the Messiah, they also began to treat themselves with extraordinary care. As time went by, people visiting the church noticed the aura of respect and gentle kindness that surrounded the 5 members of the small church. Hardly knowing why, more people began to come back to the church. They began to bring friends, and their friends brought more friends. Within a few years, the small church had once again become a thriving church, thanks to the bishop's gift.